How long into that journey is it that some of those attributes around that resilience become obvious to you in that?
I think it's difficult to test resilience in a process, to be honest. I mean, you can do it for second-time founders. You can do it with people who've done things before. You can demonstrate that outside of work, but it's easier to show resilience in companies that you're genuinely passionate about, an authentic connection with the problem you're trying to solve. So that can help with resilience. Like, I think that's the first thing. Yeah, is this a big problem? Is it important? Is it solvable? And why are you the one that's going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and solve this problem? What's the thing that for you personally makes this? So I think that's probably the connection you're looking for.
Welcome to the Dion Gugliotto podcast, where I interview business people who run or have sold businesses worth a few million dollars all the way through to billions of dollars. While most of my time is spent managing investment portfolios for people after they've had a successful exit, I've always been fascinated by the entire process and hearing the insights that successful entrepreneurs and business people have learned along their journey. At Fortress Family Office, we're an investment portfolio manager and we manage portfolios for ultra high net worth families. If you'd like to know more about not only the way we approach investment markets, but our philosophy on life and business, feel free to subscribe to my weekly insights note. Go to www.fortressfamilyoffice.com and hit subscribe. In this episode, I interview Craig Blair, co-founder of Airtree, one of the largest VC firms in Australia. Airtree has been an early investor in some of the country's biggest startups, such as Canva, Mr. Yum, and Linktree. Founded in 2014, Craig has helped grow the business to now manage over $1.3 billion with over 80 active investments. Craig talks about his journey starting as a country kid, beginning his own construction business, and owning a profitable business during the dot-com era, and now his success with Airtree. He also talks about the characteristics that make the best founders, and interestingly, the benefits of reading fiction. If you enjoy this episode, feel free to leave a 5-star review and share with your family and friends. Craig, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dion. Great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Do you want us to start by telling us how you got into the VC game and give us a little bit of your background from the early days?
Yeah, so we were talking about this before, like how far do you want to go back? But I would say beginning of life, I'm a country kid. I grew up in rural New South Wales. I was an engineer and I worked in engineering for a while. And I'm going to skip forward a few years. And through a sort of strange twist of fate, I ended up with my own construction company in Prague, all places. And I was running this construction site, which turned to a business. And then I realized, God, I don't really know what a debit and credit is. Like, I need to figure out what this business thing is. And so I thought I better go off to business school. I didn't have any money. So I managed to sell my crappy little business for 100,000 euros when I was 26 years old. And that gave me the money to fund myself into an MBA, a place called INSEAD in France.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't know it at the time, but I just thought that was a transaction. But I sort of now realize that's kind of the cycle of life in a business. Like a very small, it's somewhat trivial. I normally don't talk about that, but like, how do you get money out of the business at the end of it and do something with that? And then I've done strategy consulting work and I can do PowerPoint presentations and 2x2 matrices and lots of stuff, but it really wasn't for me. And then I guess it really started to hit the road when I founded a business called Travel Select in the UK, which was one of the very first online travel companies in the late 90s, the dot-com boom. Don't know how much you remember about the dot-com, but it was a train wreck in many ways. But the things that did work was travel. And travel, we were lucky. I picked a sector that I was interested in. It was. And so we raised £5 million, $7 million off in VC funding. We built a team. We grew the business up. We shrunk the team. We made mistakes. We went through the 9/11, the dot-com crash. But over 5 to 6 years, we built a business that was profitable, actually, which was kind of unusual in the dot-com era.
Profitable tech business in the dot-com era.
Yeah, we were very uncool. And we sold that business. We sold that into a listed entity called lastminute.com. It was a $100 million plus transaction. It wasn't massive. It wasn't on the FT, but it was a really good insight into idea, capital, team, product, mistakes, fix things, come out the other end and sell a business. And so that was my first, like, oh my goodness, that's the cycle of life in a business. And that's what it looks like.
But life-changing outcome too, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, I thought so because I retired. And that was such a dumb decision. Like, firstly, dumb because I probably didn't have enough to retire. And second, I know now. And secondly, you know, why would you retire? Like, it's just a thing to do when you're 33, 34 years old. But I think it was life-changing. And like, on a slightly doors, like I could be working in a consulting house, you know, doing PowerPoint presentations. Well, I'm not that person. So that's good. And then I guess I came back to Australia with my wife and that's when I got started my VC journey. So I was in a VC firm. I've been in VC for 20 years. So a VC firm called Netas with my co-founder and it was a successful VC firm. And then I co-founded Airtree 10 years ago. Now it's a large multi-stage VC in Australia. We backed about 100 companies in Australia and New Zealand. We managed over $1 billion. We've returned capital to our investors with healthy returns. And I guess that's what got me sitting here today.
Yeah, it's interesting because the business over the last 10 years has grown a lot. I'll run through some names of people that we've had on our podcast. I mean, obviously, we had Daniel Petrie on the show. We had Vu Tran from Go One, Nick Humphreys from Linktree, Mark Woodland from Explorer. They've all been on the show and all speak very highly of Airtree and all in their own right have been extremely successful. But you've also had a bunch of other companies that are probably even, you know, Canva and Employment Hero and that type of thing. When you meet founders, just looking through that list, do you ever meet them and sort of at the first moment think, yeah, well, these guys are going to be successful? Do you know early or is it different for everybody?
I think there's a common kind of meme in venture about is it the idea or the people, and the idea is this something sudden spark, you know. I think that's a bit of Nostradamus retrospective thinking in VC. What I've learned is like founders can come in from very different forms, you know, and I think the mistake we can sometimes make is be looking for this impressive founder who presents well and clearly articulated a vision, you know, evangelize an idea. And they're important, but sometimes you get founders who don't fit those models and they're awesome. So, you know, I mean, some of our best companies in the firm wouldn't really blow you off the chair in that first meeting. There's a sort of behind that, there's a quiet resilience and determination. There's a probably a contrarian first principle thinking. The fact they're sitting there pitching a business already puts them on the spectrum, some sort of spectrum. So they thought they're not normal people. So I say, no, I mean, occasionally you go, I like this person, I get it. But like mostly it's like you can come just accepting that founders can come from anywhere. And it'll take a few meetings, a few to try and understand how they tick and why they would be a good fit for that business.
Yeah. How long into that journey is it that some of those attributes around that resilience and those, because that's obviously, they're intangibles, right? You can see the resume, you can see what they're doing, you can see where they've been, et cetera. But to see that, when does that become obvious to you in that? Is it just through that process?
Well, I think it's difficult to test resilience in a process, to be honest. I mean, you can do it for second time founders. You can do it with people who've done things before. You can do it
sure
done and demonstrate that outside of work. But it's easier to show resilience in companies that you're genuinely passionate about. Like you've got a genuine, authentic connection with the problem you're trying to solve. So that can help with resilience. Like, I think that's the first thing. Why is, you know, is this a big problem? Is it important? Is it solvable? And why are you the one that's going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and solve this problem? What's the thing that for you personally makes this? So I think that's probably the connection you're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about potential here, right? In effect, because you guys are looking at a company that's not that different in some respects to sort of like the NBA draft or basketball, that type of thing. You know, you've got these lottery picks in the, you know, number pick 1 through to 14. They pick the people early because they've got all these attributes that tick the boxes, but it's not until later on you see whether they really have a love of the game. They really want to win. They've got that resilience when they get injured and they want to play on. And it's difficult. So the success rate of that, even when you look at everyone and go, that's a great prospect, it's the same sort of thing, right? And it's hard to find out until you're actually under fire and right in the throes of it.
It is. And I guess, but I think in some ways it does self-select. I mean, you know, we occasionally back founders who are still on a job, but often, most often they've left a pretty safe job and they've got a wife, sometimes kids, like they've got commitments and they're taking a bet on something which is irrational in many ways. So that's already a sort of decent selection point. They're making this stuff up. And they're probably, you know, when they take money from any VC, they're probably not going to earn much money. So that they're putting it all on the back end. So there's a few signals there that says this, you know, there's a decent filter up to get to that point. But then you're right, beyond that, who are the people who are really going to go the mile?
Just taking a step back to when you were talking about your building company that you founded, what were the biggest lessons you got out of that first company and exit, regardless of whether it was a small exit or not? You must have got some lessons out of that apply to what you do now even.
I just was so naive. I just really didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't think I knew what I was doing either. So the business side.
Right.
So that was probably a good thing. I think the lessons I would take is when I went off and did an MBA, and for me, there's a whole bunch of mystery around business and finance and strategy and marketing. And I realized after doing it and working out, it's actually not that hard. Like there's many, much, much harder things in engineering. Like it's not that hard conceptually to do.
In hindsight, would you do an MBA again, knowing what you know now? I've done an MBA, the reason I ask it. And I think there's a lot you can learn just from reading, but I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Yeah, no, I get asked this a lot by people, and I guess I answered it a few ways. I mean, for me, I was making a career shift. I had a very deep the engineering context, you know, maths, medicine, problem solving, which is great, but it's not very broad. And so for me, it was useful content. You could get the content elsewhere, your point, and especially now. But I would say for me, I would do it in a heartbeat. If you can go to one of the top schools in the world,
that's true. Yeah.
It's up in points to, you know, 10 friends I've got around the world who's just doing very, very interesting things. As humans, you just wouldn't get to meet otherwise. And so I would go for the people. The content you get elsewhere, but I go for the people. And there is something about you're in the SES, like you're in the
INSEAD is elite, and that would be excellent.
And like it shows up, like, you know, it's like everyone's pretty bright, everyone's pretty driven, everyone's got different stories. You know, you're not that unique, and so that's an interesting test.
Yeah, okay. Then you go into the next business. What were the biggest lessons you got from going through that process?
I think the lessons which I still apply to venture today is like in the .com, we were a prime fighter for founders. Like we were late 20s, yes, driven people to found businesses. And there were lots of like, what's the internet going to spawn? What's the big idea it's going to spawn?
Yeah.
And I didn't know it then, but I felt like I could see. I remember having conversations. I joke, beds and bulldozers. I just remember to a friend saying, so bulldozers online, beds online. I'm like, oh my God, I can see at some point, what does it happen now in the next 3 or 4 years? And so in some ways, I had a lack of ambition. Like I said, I can travel, I can see just the sheer booking process. It's a booking process that can be done better on a screen. And then at that time, you had to sell physical tickets. If they can become electric, you don't have to go to the travel agent and get your ticket. Well, that goes away. I can see that happening in the next 2 or 3 years. And that proved to be right. That's kind of why travel was one of the things that worked. It was a genuine disruptor to that sector. So I think the thing I learned is like, maybe the big ambitious idea with a 20-year time frame is not the thing to bet your career on, or certainly investing in. Like, what's going to work in the next 5 to 10 years? Yeah. So I think I was lucky, but I guess that was probably less than. And then I think the other thing is it's much, much harder than you think, way harder than you think. The lows are terrible. The highs are fleeting, but they're really interesting. You know, it is definitely not a risk-adjusted, sensible career move. It's okay if you pull it off, but if you don't, it's got a lot of scars to your back. You have to enjoy it. You have to enjoy the journey. You have to enjoy the hustle and tussle and the ambiguity and the grayness and just this sort of agency, I guess, you get from doing it.
What benefits did you find from having that engineering sort of background and mindset in that business? Because presumably there's a way you tackle problems that's different to other people who don't have that sort of background, I would expect.
Yeah, pretty structured thinker. I'm comfortable with numbers. I can work my way through problems pretty easily. I mean, I think I shouldn't take that for granted. Like, you don't get that with all degrees and background. So that was useful. But I think I found it particularly relevant. I came in and ran a bunch of functions, but like maybe after 6 or 12 months, I ran the marketing function, right? Like, who would have thought an engineer running marketing? It's not just what you do. But in those days, it was the beginning of programmatic marketing where you sort of buying, you were doing deals with ISPs. This is before search engine marketing, but you were doing, you're basically traders trying to figure out a return on investment for selling $1. And so I built a team of physicists and engineers, actually. They weren't marketers at all. They were basically traders. And it was just a hard, quant-driven approach to marketing, which worked now, but it worked in the late 90s. And so that was the interesting application of engineering into a problem I didn't expect.
What lessons being involved in that dot-com boom and bust did you see sort of in the way you go about business now, and what the trips and traps that you see that maybe others who haven't been through that process don't necessarily see? What does that sort of insight look like for you?
I think you see it, the hype and the fervor and the excitement that comes from a new platform shift is palpable. You know, the advance, the energy, is really, really interesting, and it's a necessary driver of like this ambition and new ideas coming out of it. It can definitely, people can drink cordial too much, get away with things. And it's an overused term, but like almost certainly overestimate the short-term implications of it. Like, it's not going to happen as soon as you think, and potentially underestimate the long-term impacts. You get a lot of sort of people coming into the space. You know, like it was engineers, and it was like, you know, business people, then it was the property people. Like, there were a lot of sharks coming in, so you know, try to feed on the frenzy, and they generally don't last. But I think that, you know, the people who weren't just learning for the money, they were in it because they liked innovation. They enjoy technology as a disruptor. They're the ones that stick around because it's kind of what they want to do. Right? When you saw the dot-com crash, a lot of people went back to their safe job. They went back to running property things. They went back to investment banking. It wasn't where they should be in the first place.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Talking about resilience earlier in the conversation, is there a company that you've come across that sort of I'll say favorite company, but one that has sort of overcome the odds that, you know, were just totally stacked against them, and they've got an outcome that was disproportionate to what they probably should have just because of their grit.
I think the celebrated successes all have elements of that, but you read about the papers, like, you know, I mean, the Go Ones, the Employment Heroes, the Pet Circles, the Canvas, I mean, everyone thinks it's just this massive result just pops out at the end. Well, it doesn't. These overnight successes take 10 years. There's a ton of uncertainty, a lot of near-death experiences, and a lot of worry and doubt along the way that goes with that. I think sort of people forget that. But I would say it's almost like the unsexy ones I'm most inspired by, you know, founders who, I'm not going to mention names, but they've been at it for 10 years. And if they've managed to pull a business back to break even, you know, they're not growing maybe as fast as they were, but they're still building a team. They're still passionate about the problem they're trying to solve. You can see them sell their business for like an okay amount of money. I mean, they're not going to be on a boat of a harbor, Bahamas, but more importantly, they get money back for their investors. They get something for the employees, the journey, and everyone gets a bit out of it because they stuck at it, you know, and they stuck at it. And they didn't get the $1 billion outcome, or maybe not even the $100 million outcome, but they got something out of it for them and their investors.
Which ultimately you've got to respect, right? Because the ability to keep on going and go as well as you can go, because people talk about that, and that's not really celebrated if it's not the front page of the paper type outcome, but it probably should be, because it's easy to chuck in the towel, and those that don't do deserve respect.
100%. I think that comes back to, if you're in it for the money, you're probably not the right thing, because if you want to solve that problem, you've had a vision, you want to realize that vision, you want to, like, you know, return the trust that your early employees showed in you and your early investors showed in you. Like, it's a real kind of like full circle, you know, payback, and that's the motivator. It's not, you know, to kind of make a lot of money out of this thing. Like, that could happen. That's a secondary. Anyway.
What's the biggest change you've seen over the last sort of 10 years or so since you've been in the VC business with Airtree, and maybe 20 years over your whole career?
I'd say over 20 years, I'd say in the early 2000s, your founders tend to be pretty introspective, you know, usually engineers, often a bit embarrassed about pitching a big vision. They were comfortable with an Australian story, very product focused, very technical focused. And I think the more there is, we're getting people who, you know, you can read how to pitch a business. You can think of, you've seen these tremendous success stories, and you know what you might have seen what a $1 billion business looks like from the inside. You can use those words and talk about big ambition without shuffling in your chair. You can actually mean it. Ambition level ambitions increase. I think that technical founder is still there, but often you have a technical co-founder and someone who's got a drive and a vision and idea. So that sort of co-founder mentality, where it's someone who's, you know, great at commercials or great at growth or great at, you know, building a team, is a big change. And I'd say the big change is really around the platform shifts. You know, in the early 2000s, like, it was really sitting around the internet mostly, and the business model mostly is around a few industries, you know, retail and media. Well, now it's like anything from space, food, you know, government, defense, supply chains. Like, it's just so many sectors. And so that, I guess, that brings out people who have expertise in those sectors. You know, someone who's worked in putting satellites up in the air, like, you know, how can they see an opportunity to use software in a new and interesting way? Well, that's different from 20 years ago.
Yeah, okay. You're seeing people with that domain experience identify a problem, they're business oriented, and they go, we can make something here. And technology is a facilitator of all that these days. And like you say, there's a lot of learning you can do in your own time because of the accessibility of everything. Is there, when you talk about all those different domains, is there a sort of like a mega trend or something that you see that is underrated in some respects? I mean, we all know about things like AI, and even with all the hype down the track, that may end up being underrated in some respects. But is there anything that we see, all the ones that are in the bright lights, but is there a sort of a trend in potential tech that you think's underrated by people without giving away any trade secrets or anything?
As a VC, I think the only way you're going to deliver alpha is to be contrarian. There's not a VC in the world who doesn't say those words. But when you look at what they actually do, most are contrarian all the same way.
Yeah, right.
So AI is a good example. And so I think, you know, within the AI space, it's an interesting soundbite and tweet, but like, what's a really interesting space to invest? And what are areas you just can't see that's going to be a defensible business? Like, it's being very thoughtful about, you know, the chaff and the wheat in that space. And then it's like there's a temptation to move away from either, just because there's a new platform shift in this case, the old ones no longer work. Well, that's rarely the case. Sometimes they can keep working a lot. And, you know, we're still seeing business models that work. The SaaS is a good case in point. there was a meme for a while that SaaS is dead. Well, guess what? There are some very interesting things, which is being built, you know. And of course, there's new interesting platforms we're investing in as well, but it doesn't mean SaaS is dead. So I think, you know, I think just looking where other people are not looking is probably often a good place to start.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, the AI one is a good example from an investment perspective in terms of what we look at a lot of listed stuff and that sort of thing. But you see people trying to dive into and be stock pickers with some of that stuff, or look at ways to collectively access it through like an ETF. Some of those things are really hard. Whereas if you look at what happened, and I do remember the dot-com boom and bust and some of those things, a lot of the blue chip companies of the day innovated and actually brought to life some of those technologies anyway. So there's always productivity gains, profit gains, cost savings that come through for your stock standard companies if they're innovative enough. Banking's a good example. People don't remember, you used to get your paycheck, go to the bank and cash that. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that those sorts of things happened, you know, and now it's all automated. And so there's a lot of that sort of stuff that I think is missed by people as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think there can be a bias within our space is that all the innovation will accrue to startups and all the rents will come to entrepreneurs and investors like us. And I think this history says it's not the case. There's plenty of cases where the incumbents are going to capture the rents. And what I think particularly in AI, if SaaS cloud infrastructure was a very disruptive, because if your software is sitting in boxes on-prem, it's very difficult to shift from sending it through pipes and the whole revenue model that goes. It's a fundamental shift. So it's actually quite difficult to make that shift, right? But if you're a business which is already serving your customers through the cloud, you have a huge distribution base of customers. You have a lot of data which you can use to train your own models on it. Then you're in a very good position to spin up. You can hire an AI team and spin up an AI team, sit it on top of another existing LLM and provide enterprise-grade AI to your clients on your platform. Well, that's much easier than trying to start from scratch. Canva is a good example. We've done that now. So.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. What would you say is your biggest strength as a founder? How has that helped you succeed over the years?
I think that I am naturally pretty curious and I enjoy first principle thinking, which can often simplify complex problems and see things maybe from a different angle. I think it helps as an investor. It can be a pain in the butt when you try to get something done, but it's a good investor. I genuinely like people. I'm interested in people. There's also a weakness with this too, but lucky that I generally interested in people and where they come from, what drives them and what motivates them. I guess on the investor side, I've always been pretty driven and ambitious, and I think that helps to have that drive and want to test yourself, want to challenge yourself. I really come alive in risk. I'm understanding risk. What is the right amount of risk to take in a certain point in time? It's not maximizing risk. It's like optimizing risk. Sometimes it's taking risk, right? It's just like, what's a sensible thing to do? Judgment calls in that space, in those gray areas where it's like, there's no right answer. You just got to make a call.
On the basis of probabilities or whatever it might be.
Obviously thinking, when you know you're getting something wrong, but you're trying to make a judgment call and this three-dimensional chess in your head, like that's the way to go. I really like that thinking.
And with a mindset like that, was that ultimately, I mean, you talked about you briefly retired. Well, how long did you retire for when you sold the business?
I stopped work for maybe a year and a half. And my wife hated me. Okay, it was stupid. I turned into a
I mean, it sounds good in theory, right? But and I'm of the view that, I mean, I've probably never retired because this sort of stuff, like you see the old guys that do it till they're in their 90s, you know, and keeps your mind active. I think it's a good process. But did you struggle with that when you did do that? Because it was like, obviously you've got a curious mind. You're looking at, you want to solve problems, and the retirement thing just didn't make sense.
To be honest, I think for a while I was just happy to have a break because I was, I think I was pretty burnt out. So I think that was probably not the retirement. That was okay. And to not have an agenda and to be a bit sort of open-minded and just drift, I think there was, it sounds weird, but there was a healthy thing to go. But I think at some point I was like, I just needed to find something. I was just bouncing around trying to know what's the thing going to be? What's the next thing going to be? I think that's where I probably got itchy feet. And I now know what that feels like, and that's why I certainly wouldn't do that again.
Yeah. I think actually hadn't thought of that part in terms of the process of decompressing after what I assume is a busy and intense sort of period, right? So
decompressing and not having an agenda, like you need to have like open, broaden your scope of like what possibilities are out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. What about weaknesses in terms of as a leader, where were you looking at, you had a weakness that you had to work out how to rectify?
Dion, I'm flawless. So like
quick answer.
Yeah. Again, this is a tricky one because this can turn into a humble brag, right? I mean, I'd say that the pattern that I would get from feedback over the years, and I get a lot of feedback, is, I think, impatience. I want to get things done. And that can drive people nuts sometimes. And worse can happen for me. It can be demotivating. So I've had to learn how to sort of deliver messages, how to take people on a journey. I think that's a constant learning for me. I think I'm curious. I see opportunities everywhere. All my kids have ADHD. I'm blaming my wife and she's blaming me. So I don't know where I am on the thing, but I see lots of things. I say yes to too many things. I stretch myself too thin, and that hamper performance and efficiency and productivity. I'm always working on how do I bring Craig from outside work into work. I prefer Craig outside work. I want to see more of him.
What's the difference, Craig? Can I ask that?
Oh, he's much nicer and he's much kinder. Right. He's much more interesting. I think I just feel like in work, you just can get just trying to get things done, and it can be like,
yeah.
And that's not what life's about, really. Yeah.
I'm interested in, this is just an observation, where you said that one of those weaknesses might be sort of a bit impatient. And then you talked about how to deliver messages and that sort of thing. How do you become more patient? Or is that not something that needs to happen? Do you look at that and go, no, that's not actually the problem. It's just how I deliver those. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, no, I do. But I know I do, because the idea is not bad. I don't think it's, you know, I think the first thing in my impatience was probably arrogance. The arrogance to think you're the only one to try this, or you're the only one to got an answer. And like, and you know, I see this now, a lot of people who are similar stages as I was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Like, you know, sometimes the smartest person in the room, and like sometimes the answer is not sitting with you, it's sitting with the person across the room that hasn't said anything yet. You know, sometimes, you know, letting the group land a decision which is not the one you thought was right, but doing and then get lying behind it is way more powerful than, you know, my idea, which I thought was good. So I think it's just learning that it's just it's probably wrong. Like, it's just wrong. Like, you need to trust that other people could have better ideas, and probably do have better ideas, frankly, and trust that the groups buy into that. It's much more important than just getting things done.
Was there a point in time when you realized that you were thinking more along those lines, or it just evolved over time?
I've had a lot of feedback throughout the years. And I think it wasn't lost on me. I think it might have just been, dare I say, maturing a bit, like just growing up a bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, as a parent, as a boss and that sort of thing, I found personally that I became better with people once I started looking at my role as a leader in the business more along the lines of coaching, when I would coach my kids in their teams, which I was actually intuitively pretty good at that. And you nurture them and coach them, was hard on them, but I was there and all that sort of stuff. And I had a different sort of approach within business. And once the people, my kids got older, I started realizing that, I don't know why, but it clicked, that coaching type mentality is probably a better approach than what I was previously doing. And it changes your mindset.
I think that's a good point. Actually, I probably was more of a manager, less of a leader in the past. I think I've learned to be a manager and probably a better leader. And then also understanding what my leadership style, what works best for me. And I'm not a big believer of the rah-rah speeches, and that I just do the right thing at the right time. And you do it consistently. Hopefully they'll start doing the same thing.
Yeah. And they learn by watching a lot of times, and you don't realize just quite how much they do watch.
Yeah. Although they still got the opposite way. How many things
I do. 100% true. I think my youngest is 20, and sometimes she'll just do things. And I actually said to him once, I said, you're simply doing that because I said to do this. He goes, yes, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Exactly.
And, you know, didn't even try and hide it.
And you probably did the same. I'm sure I did too. That's just part of growing up, right?
The nature. What about the best advice you've ever given, Craig, as you've gone through that process?
When I get asked this question, I think you're looking for like a nice pithy line that lands, and like that's the moment you thought. But I think there's probably one of those, and then another one was just a sort of general sense of how to do things. Like the first one was like, you know, trust your swing. Just trust your swing. I think that especially in startup land, like you don't know what you're doing. You're trying to make a judgment call in this, you know, in the internet where things are forming. It's like, and you just got to go with your gut feel and trust your swing on that. And that as a sort of left brain analytical math, you know, engineer, that can sometimes be a problem. But we firstly have a swing and make a decision and go for it. And then secondly, trust is going to be okay. You know, with the right input, that's fine.
That's a great answer. We are after those very raw, not pithy, as you said. We want to know the real, whatever the best advice you're ever given or learned, whatever it is, well, fire away.
The one that's come from a variety of mentors and people I respect over years is really just around relationships. I think that's probably the one. Like, and I can't put a single word on it, but there's lots of it. But it's really understanding the importance of relationships. You know, and if you look at Airtree, we've had investors who've been with us for 10 years who put money in our fund when it wasn't obvious, right? And they did that a lot of trust and belief. We've had founders sitting with us for 10 years and like partners with us. So I think that relationship matters. I think in doing that in a way which doesn't destroy it, you still retain your integrity. You're going to tell the truth. You can disagree when, you know, but be open and transparent, you know, disagree respectfully, hopefully, you know, and getting that balance right between not just solving for the short-term relationship, you know, making sure it's a real deep, meaningful relationship where you can disagree and you can, you're all shooting for the same goal. And when you're not, that's also okay. I think that's probably the thing I've learned the most and that's been the most powerful.
Is relationship. Is that the advice you would give to someone starting in business? What's the foundation piece of advice you would give?
Yeah, I would. I think I was probably way too brash and way too outcome focused and way too short-termist and early on. So I was more patient and realized that the person, you know, who I could shudder at some sort of, you know, behavior when I was in my 20s and 30s, like their outcomes would have been almost as good, maybe even better, with a better relational outcome.
Yeah, okay. No, that's a really good insight.
I like people that I had very good relationships after work. It's just like, it's, you know, it doesn't have to be a clash. Yeah, so.
Yeah, no, that's a good insight. And I think that's probably also something that gets easier as you get older as well. Like you say earlier, you're talking about a bit of maturity and that sort of stuff. I think that probably comes with time or gets easier to do with time in terms of understanding that. I know myself, when you're younger, you tend to be a bit more brash and that type of thing. So maybe that's lost on youth sometimes, just how important those relationships are. You tend to appreciate as you get older.
Yeah. Although I think the next generation is better at it. I think they're probably going to get there way before I did, because they're better in most ways. So I think that's progress. That's good.
Yeah, I think you're right. I look at the younger generation and they actually just seem to be, especially where I came from, they just seem to be much nicer people. It sounds weird, but they're much more tolerant, much more understanding, and yeah, much more collaborative. It's a different mindset. What about a business person that inspires you the most?
I mean, one of the reasons why I enjoy working in venture is the privilege of sitting alongside a founder who's taken the plunge against the odds and then going through that whole up and down journey of a founder. I think that's just the courage to do that, and the resilience. You know, I know what it's like. I've done it before, but just, you know, seeing that over and over again, that's a source of inspiration. It's people taking the path less traveled, they're following their passion, and they're having a crack at something. I think there's a specific example. I just came back from the Congo 6 weeks ago, visiting a friend who actually I was in business school with. Yeah, one of these people,
okay,
I'd say. And yeah, he was a PhD. He was a very successful guy working consulting, heading the business. He gave it all up to work for Medicine Sans Frontières. And so he worked in Doctors Without Borders in a whole host of Afghanistan, Gaza. And he's now running UNICEF in the Congo, right? And so his job is to get medicine in, vaccinations, look after children in a country the size of Western Europe with 250 million people. It's a massive, massive problem. But he does that because he's passionate. He does that because it's impactful, clearly. He does it with a smile on his face. I just think it's so admirable. So I think the types of people I tend to get drawn.
More cause or mission focused in that respect.
Yeah, but I don't think it has to be. I don't think it has to be ground. I mean, I've got another good friend who she just gave up a high paced career job in advertising. She just gave up to become a nurse.
Yep.
Like every nurse. I just think that's a very outrageous move to go to something which means something to you.
Yeah. And it's obviously something someone's passionate about, right? What about business books? Any favorite business books you'd recommend?
Oh, goodness. I feel like I've read all the ones you'd imagine people have read. We can listen more here.
What comes to mind as soon as I say it? What's the first book that sort of pops into your head?
Hard Things by Hard Things by Ben Horowitz, you know, stuff by Simon Sinek. But I actually find, to be honest, I find them quite derivative. I find the content is usually worth maybe an essay, but not a book.
Yeah. They filled it out and padded it out. Yep.
Yeah. So I guess I try and encourage people to read fiction.
Okay.
I think fiction's where you can really develop your empathy and your imagination. And I think, you know, for someone like me, and I think in our background, I think creativity and imagination, they're the missing pieces in us. It's not whether you understand the mechanics of the business or whether you understand technology. That's easy stuff. Like, if you can 2x your empathy and creativity, I think that's a really interesting thing to do. And I guess at the moment, I'm just trying to work my way through the Pulitzer Prize winners, actually. So I read a book called Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. She won the last Pulitzer Prize. It's a version of Copperfield, David Copperfield. A story by Richard Powers. So all those are the Pulitzer Prize winners for the last 10 years. So I'm finding that's what I go to bed with, what I want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and read, and that's what keeps me going.
Okay, that's interesting. I like the idea of the rationale behind fiction. Do you think that is partially because you've also read all of those other other books. Do you know what I mean? Like, and there's some level of redundancy amongst all of that. If you hadn't read all that and you're looking to go into business 20 years ago, would that be more relevant, or would you start off with fiction if you were to, you know, start over with a clean slate?
I never gave up fiction, so I've always read. So I think I think it's an and. I think you do have to read the books for sure, like, and you have to work your way through and probably get tired of them. But I would always have a fiction book going at some point in time.
Yeah. No, that makes
sense. I think it's sadly what I notice amongst young, ambitious people, particularly males, unfortunately, is that they tend to sort of throw the fiction away in pursuit of just, you know, nonfiction books. And I think that's a miss.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. I mean, even with regards to the book side, I think it comes to a point where you can read too much on those sort of interesting business type, management type, marketing, whatever they might be, books. And they come to a point where rather than consuming knowledge, you're actually far better off doing things. You know, I got to that point where I prefer to write and prefer to do a podcast and talk to people and do those rather than just consuming knowledge, because it comes to a point where there's a level of redundancy about it in that way around that sort of stuff. It comes to a point where what's all that reading for? It's just you don't apply it to something, you know?
I like that, yeah.
Any particular quotes or mantra on business or leadership that you would care to share? You might not be your cup of tea, but is there anything that comes to mind that you can...
Again, I do find these things cringe. I know they're important, don't get me wrong. I just find the words sometimes are cringy.
I think you're right. They probably are cringy. My favorite one is about life, and because I think a lot of those sorts of things you can apply to life. So it's more life-based. I probably answered the question in a wrong way, because I'll give you mine, which I've probably given to the listeners many times before, but it's around the German philosopher poet Goethe says of life, enjoy when you can, endure when you must. And he was just talking about life. Enjoy it when you can and endure it when you must. And in any tough time, I just look at that. And it personally, that resonates. And it's one of those simple things that I go back to time and time again, where you just got to get on with it. Now, I find that useful.
I think I'm more comfortable in those areas. I agree with those things. You know, this too shall pass. So things like that can be useful. I think the ones that we were talking about before we jumped on here about eulogies we just have to write. I had to write. That made me really reflect on what is life about? Like I came up with a version which was sort of, you know, at the end of the day, what the question that we all get asked is, was I loved and did I love? And I don't know if it's a motto, but I thought that was my most recent summation about what I think I'd sort of leave with when someone's giving my eulogy. I think it's not what I did, it's how I did it. It's the people I did it with.
Yeah. As we did discuss earlier around those sorts of things where there's been loss and those sort of things, I'm talking about eulogy specifically. I mean, that is what it boils down to. This sounds a little bit deep and heavy, but you can put all that other stuff to the side when it comes to business and sport and all that sort of stuff, because the only reason we're doing any of that stuff is as a part of what you're doing in life, right? So when you can actually, what those sorts of things force you to do is actually confront the core questions of what it is to be a human and person. And so if you can answer those in some way, shape that has meaning, I think that's just about all of the battle, if you want to simplify it. What about Airtree and what's next in the next sort of 5-10 years?
Well, I think we're having our 10-year anniversary now. It was 10 years ago we started forming Airtree. Yeah, we've raised our first fund the year after. So it's gone from, the ambition was always to build a, you know, long-term enduring firm that made an impact on innovation, technology, made returns for investors, which were like consistent and attractive. So I think that fire still burns. So I've just taken some time off to deal with a few health things. I come back and that's something I want to keep doing a lot and be a big part of. I'm very excited about where I just came from a roundtable, actually, where innovation and technology, software technology in particular, can take the country. I think it's going to be more and more interesting companies. There are going to be more and more jobs created, and not only number of jobs, but types of jobs created. You know, our kids are going to be doing jobs that don't exist today. So, you know, we want to be a part of that. We've invested in 100 companies. Could that be 1,000 companies at some point in time? And I was embarrassed when I said 100. Well, maybe it can be 10x that, you know? So I think if you do that, you really have made a dent on the Australian innovation ecosystem. You've hopefully developed the next generation of VCs and the one after that and the one after that. So that's the ambition, the long-term ambition.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting. Craig, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was fascinating to chat.
Thanks, Dion. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, we would really appreciate it if you would leave a 5-star review and share with family and friends. Thanks.